From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. President Trump says he'll pursue ending birthright citizenship. White House lawyers are reportedly working on ways the president could bar from citizenship the children of non-citizens. The 14th Amendment gives citizenship to anyone born in the U.S. We'll look at whether birthright citizenship should be changed and what the legal possibilities are for the president right after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a superb start to your day. Coming up a little bit later, we're going to debate Proposition 6, the gas tax repeal. This is going to be our major takeout on it, to really spend considerable time debating the repeal of the gas tax and the increase of the vehicle license fee. We're also going to ask whether people who limit the number of sex partners they have before marriage end up having more satisfying marriages. A new study out at the University of Utah makes such a contention. We'll get your thoughts about that coming up a little bit later on the program. But first, in an interview aired last night on the show Axios on HBO, President Trump told a reporter Jonathan Swan that he's preparing an executive order on birthright citizenship.
On immigration, some legal scholars believe you can get rid of birthright citizenship without changing the Constitution.
With an executive order.
Exactly.
Right.
Have you thought about that?
Yes.
Tell me more.
It was always told to me that you needed a constitutional amendment.
Right. 14th Amendment.
You don't. Number one, you don't need that. Number two,
I mean, that's in dispute.
You could definitely
in dispute.
Well, you can definitely do it with an act of Congress, but now they're saying I can do it just with an executive order. Now, how ridiculous. We're the only country in the world where a person comes in, has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States for 85 years with all of those benefits. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And it has to end.
Have you talked about that with counsel?
Yeah, I have.
So where in the process?
It's in the process. It'll happen.
So we have two major questions to ask over the course of the next half hour or so, and that is, first of all, would this be a good idea? Should the U.S. change its policy of every child born in the United States having automatic citizenship? Should only the children of citizens of the United States have automatic birthright citizenship? And then a little bit later, we'll talk about the legal issues. Is there a legal leg for the president to stand on here in some way through an executive order being able to undo that portion of the 14th Amendment, which grants citizenship to every child born in the U.S. First of all, on the issue of whether birthright citizenship is a positive or not, Jessica Vaughn, Director of Policy Studies at the Center for Immigration Studies in D.C. Jessica, good to have you with us again.
Thanks. Glad to talk with you.
I appreciate it. So why do you think it's not in the country's best interest to allow those, the offspring of those who are non-citizens to have automatic citizenship?
Well, it does create an incentive to illegal immigration, for one thing. And I should back up a minute. The president hasn't specified, and we won't really know until such an executive order comes out. But I'm pretty sure that what the president has in mind is ending automatic citizenship for the children of people in the country illegally, not necessarily all non-citizens. But
okay. So those who have green card holders, for example, potentially their children would have automatic citizenship.
Yes, because that was covered in an old Supreme Court case, Wong v. Ark, that established that a child of a lawful permanent resident was, in fact, a citizen.
Okay.
I think that is pretty settled, most people think anyway, but we'll see what the president has in mind. The reason this is such a problem and why the president wants to deal with it and why Americans are always scratching their head over this is that it is an incentive to illegal immigration. There are approximately 300,000 births estimated to occur in our country to mothers who are in the country illegally. And so that's, you know, that's a pretty significant number. And this gets to be costly because these U.S.-born children become entitled to an array of welfare benefits if they are, you know, qualified on the basis of income, things like Medicaid and access to public housing and food stamps, and then a whole array of public assistance programs because of the fact that they're citizens. And this is one reason why we have such a high percentage of illegal alien-headed households that are taking advantage of these welfare programs. So it's pretty costly. It's also spawned an industry of birth tourism where people from all over the world come here specifically to have children so that they can leave with that with their baby and a U.S. passport for that child and the opportunity for that child to come live here permanently in the future, perhaps, and even sponsor the parents for legal immigration benefits.
So in that case, though, I'm wondering how it would apply, because if you have someone, a woman who comes from a country on a 3-month tourist visa, for example, and then delivers her baby here in the United States, that person wouldn't be in the country illegally. So wouldn't there still be the ability of birthright citizenship there?
Well, it depends on whether they were honest about the reason for their entry when they came into the country. Sometimes people don't reveal to the immigration officers or to the consular officer that issued the visa that their real purpose was to have a baby here. That right now it's not illegal to do that if you thought about that in the beginning. This could lead to a discussion of citizenship retention rights. Also, there are a lot of countries that offer citizenship by birth in the country, but require people to continue living here in order to retain that citizenship. So we might see that.
Is there any country in the world, Jessica, that has something comparable to the U.S.'s birthright citizenship?
There are a few countries in the world, but there are no developed nations that have this. Some of them used to have it and recently got rid of it, like the UK and a few other places. France has this situation where they have it, but you have to apply at the age of 18 after having lived in the country in order to retain it. So, but we are the only major developed country that grant citizenship to anyone born here.
We're talking with Jessica Vaughn of the Center for Immigration Studies, also with us from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, the director of the Trade and Immigration Program, Daniel Griswold. Sir, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jessica.
So what do you see as the advantage of continuing to offer birthright citizenship in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think it's been a great success for America. It's been one reason why we have been more successful than most other nations at assimilating immigrants. It virtually guarantees that second-generation immigrants assimilate to the United States. They are citizens at birth. They see themselves as Americans. They invest more in their language and their educational skills. We've been fabulously successful at incorporating second- and third-generation immigrants into the great American fabric. And it also protects us against having a kind of permanent underclass, I wouldn't even say second-class citizens, of non-citizens, second- and third-generation non-citizens. Other countries have struggled with that. Germany, they had Turks and other ethnic minorities come in the 50s and 60s when they needed labor. They wouldn't give them citizenship, and they ended up having social problems because of that. Japan as well. They have third-generation immigrants from Korea who are not allowed to become citizens, and that creates divisions. We've avoided that because of the 14th Amendment, because of birthright citizenship. It has not led to widespread problems of birth tourism. And actually, a fairly small percentage of births in the United States are to illegal immigrants. And the fact that their children are citizens, I think, is a strength. Jessica and others seem to see immigrants as a liability. They're an asset to the United States, especially as we go through a demographic transition. We need immigrants, and it's better that the children of immigrants who are born here in the United States are citizens. There's no question about it. I think the constitutional bedrock of that principle is established. I don't know what the president's talking about in terms of an executive order. I think that'll be swatted down by the courts in an afternoon.
We're talking with Daniel Griswold, the Mercatus Center at George Mason University in Virginia, Jessica Vaughn of the Center for Immigration Studies. My question for you is, do you think that it would be good for the United States to change its policy as embodied in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which allows automatic citizenship at birth for any child that's born in the United States? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Jessica, I wanted to ask you about your point that we incentivize illegal immigration because people come here, can have their children here, they're automatically citizens, get all the benefits that come with that, and it's an automatic life improvement for the family. But let's say that if birthright citizenship was done away with, so maybe you would have fewer people that would come here and have children here who are undocumented. But wouldn't you still end up with some people who do have their children here and that they would be left in that sort of perpetual second-class citizenship that Daniel Griswold just mentioned?
Well, that is a possibility, and I think that's one reason why people have thought twice about trying to change how we apply birthright citizenship. I think that's a legitimate concern, but I also think it's a concern that can be dealt with through the enactment of laws to cover situations like that, just as we've done with other immigration problems over the years and the way other countries deal with this. As I mentioned, France has decided to have those born in the country come forward and apply for citizenship after a certain period of time and give them that opportunity if they wish to take advantage of it. And that's something we could do as well if Congress decided that that would be a good answer to this issue.
I also wonder about the whole assimilation thing, because, again, if someone is born here in the United States, odds are they're not going to the country back to the country that their parents came from. This is their home. And almost certainly they are born to someone who is of a lower economic status. That's what brought the parents to the U.S. in the first place. How do they kind of get the toehold to get out of that if that's the strata that they're stuck in? Jessica and then Daniel. Go ahead, Jessica.
And that's an immigration enforcement issue, and it's also something that can be dealt with by Congress if they were to decide to enact an amnesty that would cover the entire family or allow some kind of status for them. But the point is that these are questions that our elected representatives would be able to solve.
All right. And Daniel, go ahead.
Yeah, Larry, you make a good point. I think it would be even harder for the second generation of immigrants to work their way out of the poverty that some first generation immigrants have if they aren't citizens. Being citizens gives them an advantage. Yes, they qualify for certain income support programs, but I think their use of that is exaggerated. They're also more likely to become productive, taxpaying U.S. citizens, and we need more of them. You know, I don't think France is a particularly good example for the United States of how to integrate immigrants. I think they struggle more than we do, and I think one reason is we have birthright citizenship. We embrace the children of immigrants born here in the United States as U.S. citizens right from the beginning. That's an advantage that helps them assimilate, that helps them become productive members of society and contributors to society. We should see immigrants just as we see children generally as assets for the United States, helping us build a brighter future, not as liabilities. And I think that's where the president and others have made a big mistake looking at this issue.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Daniel Griswold, the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He directs the Trade and Immigration Program. And our thanks to Jessica Vaughn of the Center for Immigration Studies in D.C. She directs policy studies for CIS. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, a legal debate over whether President Trump would have the ability through an executive order to ban the automatic citizenship of children born to those in the U.S. illegally. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. You can comment about President Trump's comment in an interview aired last night on the show Axios on HBO, in which the president said that he believes he does have the ability legally to end birthright citizenship for the children of those in the country illegally. We have a number of comments already coming in. Cheryl in Anaheim writes on the page, in theory, I could get behind ending birthright citizenship, but only in the context of a genuine fix to our broken immigration system, legislation that reflects our history of welcoming immigrants, refugees, otherwise. Diego writes on the page, ending birthright citizenship isn't an outrageous idea. Most other nations require at least one parent to be a citizen in order for the child to be a citizen. But the president can't just unilaterally end it. It requires amending the Constitution. That's Diego writing on the Air Talk page. Well, let me begin the legal portion of our conversation by reading the 14th Amendment as it pertains to citizenship. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. With us to debate whether President Trump, through an executive action, could invalidate the 14th Amendment, at least in part, is constitutional law professor at Chapman University in Orange, also senior fellow at the Claremont Institute, John Eastman. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Thanks, Larry. It's always a pleasure to be on your program.
In what way do you think that the president would have the ability to do this?
Well, I want to correct one thing you just said. Can the president alter or change the 14th Amendment? And the answer is clearly no, he cannot. But the question is, what does the 14th Amendment mean? And you read it. Modernly, it sounds like if you're just born here, then you're a citizen. But that's the birth part, all persons born or naturalized in the United States. There's also a second requirement, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And so we have to figure out what that means in a way that's not entirely redundant, because everybody that's within our territory, born here, is also subject to our jurisdiction in some sense. They're subject to our laws. Is that what that clause meant? Some have argued that it meant merely the children of diplomats are not covered by the birthright citizenship clause, but that everybody else is. But I think that's too restrictive a view. And if you look at the debates over the 14th Amendment, they thought that was too restrictive a view as well. Born here and subject to the jurisdiction meant something more than just what they called partial or territorial jurisdiction, such as applies to visitors, temporary sojourners, they call them. It meant subject in some way to the allegiance, the more complete jurisdiction. And that's why Native Americans who were born on U.S. soil were not automatic citizens. It's why people that were here as guest workers in the 1920s, their children were not deemed automatic citizens. The Braceras program in the 1950s, same thing. It meant more of that complete jurisdiction, not just territorial jurisdiction.
Well, at what point did that change then? If the children of Braceros, guest workers from Mexico here in the United States, if they were not considered U.S. citizens upon birth here, when did that change?
I've been debating this and researching it for over 15 years, and I've challenged everybody that's taken the opposite side from me to explain when that happened. The nearest I've been able to identify is a change in the passport office form that used to ask, if you were born here, what was the status of your parents? And then in the late 1960s, they just dropped the status of the parents question. No change in the law, no court decision. No executive order. It just, it was almost as if we needed to fit the form onto a page, and so we dropped some of this clause that some bureaucrat thought had become unnecessary. But there was no change in the law in the interim.
Fascinating. I didn't realize that this is a more recent phenomenon. John Eastman, Chapman University professor of law, also with us, Kim West Falcone, who's professor at Loyola Law School. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
First of all, can you respond to what Professor Eastman was just saying, that as recently as the early 20th century, the children of guest workers born here were not granted citizenship?
Well, what Professor Eastman has articulated is a novel and certainly not the black letter law interpretation of the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment. So I'm glad to hear that your original question has been answered definitively, that it is an outrageous proposition to suggest, which President Trump has done, that he can unilaterally attempt to amend the Constitution through executive order. The abiding majority rule interpretation of the citizenship clause that all persons born in the United States are citizens is the interpretation that would apply to anyone born in the United States without regard to the citizenship status of their parents. So what Professor Eastman has described would be a novel interpretation, and one that, if it were a student on my constitutional law exam were to put that forth, that would not be a correct understanding of what the Constitution currently means.
And Professor Eastman, you want to respond to that?
Well, it's neither novel nor unique. The president isn't changing. Here's what the authors of the language said when asked this very question. Do you mean partial jurisdiction or do you mean complete jurisdiction? Senator Lyman Trumbull, the key figure for the 14th Amendment, said it means complete jurisdiction, not owing allegiance to anybody else. Senator Jacob Howard, who actually introduced this precise language, said it means, quote, a full and complete jurisdiction. They were codifying the 1866 Civil Rights Act, which said all persons born here and not subject to any foreign power will be citizens. And so the novel construction is the one that your other guest just offered. The Supreme Court has never held that the children of anybody born here on U.S. soil are automatic citizens. It did hold in 1898 that the child of lawful permanent residents, people who were legally domiciled in the country, were citizens. But that's a vast different claim than those who are temporarily here as on a tourist visa or a student visa, and certainly a vastly different claim than people who are not here lawfully in the first place.
So again, your interpretation of the 14th is, when it says subject to the jurisdiction thereof, means that people that are not in the country illegally by definition, they are not subject to the jurisdiction thereof.
They are subject to the partial territorial jurisdiction. They have to comply with our laws, but they are not subject to the more complete jurisdiction that the authors of that language specifically said was intended.
So, Professor West Falcone, if the intent of the 14th was to just blanketly say that anyone born on U.S. soil is a U.S. citizen, why does it say subject to the jurisdiction thereof? Why was that even bothered with? Professor?
To back into the purpose and the meaning of the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment, it is important to understand when the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were added to the Constitution. We commonly refer to them as the post-Civil War amendments. So they were the amendments that were added after the country went through the Civil War. The opinion by the Supreme Court, Dred Scott versus Sanford, is the opinion that was changed and in some ways overturned by the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment. In Dred Scott versus Sanford, the court held in what is seen as one of its worst decisions of all time that if you were of African ancestry, you could not be a citizen of the United States. And that would be irrespective of whether you were an enslaved person or a free person of African ancestry. So that's the history that underlies the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment, that we had a U.S. Supreme Court that was not interested in protecting the rights of all and very much ruled in an opinion that, again, it took a civil war to overturn that because of your racial ancestry, you could not be a citizen. So the main point that I am seeking to make about the language of the Citizenship Clause is that it is very declarative of who is born here, you are a citizen.
But I'm still not understanding the phrase, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, how does that specifically relate to those that were enslaved?
Well, what I'm saying is I think it's Professor Eastman's goal to cloud what I think on a day when we have the President of the United States making a very dangerous assertion. It's the kind of assertion that an autocrat and a dictator would make, which is that he could somehow, through executive order, amend the Constitution. Professor Eastman is engaging in a topic that would be absolutely appropriate in a law review article or an extensive discussion in a legal conference where we could talk about the particularities. It is absolutely true, Rick, at large, that if you are an undocumented non-citizen, that you are treated differently than someone who has entered the country according to the proper channels and laws. That's an overarching accuracy with respect to how our laws work, and the Constitution does not change the fact that you have entered the United States illegally. But, Larry, I do want to make sure that, again, on a day when the rule of law is being questioned so fundamentally that we don't fall prey to distraction.
Well, I guess the point is, though, it's important to debate this, because if the president attempts to do it, then we'd like to have a sense of how courts are going to treat this, right?
Well, not really, because what we are talking about now, if we talk about the wording of the current Citizenship Clause, is how might a court interpret it? That would include the Supreme Court. That's not the issue that President Trump has raised by his assertion that he could, through an executive order, essentially repeal or amend the Citizenship Clause itself. So what I'm saying is that it's a very different conversation, which Professor Eastman is provoking, which, and it's a legitimate one in a different context. It's a very legitimate conversation to discuss what do the words and the text of the Citizenship Clause itself mean. But that is not the issue that has been raised by President Trump. What he has raised is that the overarching interpretation, the interpretation that birth in this country dictates citizenship, that he can somehow change that without going through the Article 5 amendment process is what is the incendiary assertion that President Trump has made.
Professor Eastman, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, this is really stunning. I've never debated this issue with somebody that delighted such a level of ignorance about what the conversation is about. President Trump has not said he can unilaterally amend the Constitution. He has said that what the Constitution has means is that you have to have not just birth on U.S. soil, you keep referring to that and completely acting like the words subject to the jurisdiction are not there, and that subject to the jurisdiction means complete jurisdiction, not partial or territorial jurisdiction. And therefore, by an executive order, I'm going to insist that executive agencies comply with the law as written, not as law professors over the last 40 or 50 years have misinterpreted it to mean. That's not only permissible for the president, but I think it's his duty. His duty under Article 2 is to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. You said that the Supreme Court has only held otherwise. It has never held in favor of granting citizenship to anybody born here without looking at the subject of the jurisdiction clause. In fact, the only time it has ever held on anything directly related to this was in a case called Elk versus Wilkins in 1884. A Native American born on U.S. soil claimed citizenship, and the Supreme Court ruled that he was not a citizen because he was a member of an Indian tribe and therefore owed immediate allegiance to the tribe and not to the United States.
All right.
Even though he was within the territory of the United States, he was not a citizen by virtue of the 14th Amendment. That's the only Supreme Court holding on.
All right. And so we'll see if the president does, in fact, pursue this, if he attempts to do it on the terms that the 14th Amendment does not provide universal birthright citizenship, or takes it on in another way. John Eastman, Chapman University Law Professor, Loyola Law School Professor, Kim West Falcone joining us on Air Talk. Coming up next, we'll take a look at some of the major changes occurring in countries like Brazil and Germany when it comes to politics there. A far-right president elected in Brazil. What is it going to mean for the future of that country? You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Back after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. On Sunday, Brazil elected a polarizing far-right populist as its new president. The South American country, the largest in South America by far, has split the country. And the question is, what is the leadership of Jair Bolsonaro going to mean for Brazil going forward? With us from the New York Times, Brazil bureau chief, he's based in Rio, Ernesto Londoño. Ernesto, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
So give us a sense, first of all, in the 48 hours since the election, how has the nation responded?
Well, this was a political earthquake, quite frankly, here. The last four presidential elections in Brazil have been won by leftists from the same party, from the Workers' Party. And voters on Sunday decided that the nation was ready for a very dramatic shift. In electing Jair Bolsonaro, who has been in Congress for nearly three decades, they elected somebody who has promised to do a number of things. He says he's going to take an iron fist to security at a time when Brazil is reeling from an epidemic of violence that is unprecedented. And he has said that he is going to disrupt the political system, which has been notoriously corrupt, and essentially end a system of kickbacks that has prevailed for decades here. However, on specific matters, it's anybody's guess, because Mr. Bolsonaro refused to debate during the past couple of months of the campaign, and has laid out only vague campaign promises. So there hasn't been much in the way of detailed policy prescriptions. So voters are still wondering what exactly this new era is going to look like.
And I want to, if we can, take a little time for a bit of a primer on Brazilian politics and government, because, you know, we know it's a huge country, but I don't have a good sense of the authority of the president versus other elected officials, how much power in Brazil is regionally distributed versus in the central government. Can you give us a bit of a sense of that?
Sure. When Brazil, when the Brazilian military dictatorship ended in the mid-80s, Brazil came up with a new constitution that created a system of government that mirrors that of the United States in many ways. So the president has considerable power, but his powers are checked by an independent judiciary and by a Congress that wields the power of the purse strings. Governors have considerable power in Brazil and historically have been leaders when it comes to security. They historically have had the final say when it comes to security matters. That may be changing soon in some important ways. For example, Mr. Bolsonaro has said he wants to make it easier for people to buy and carry weapons, civilians. So that may lead to some protracted legal and political fights. And he also has expressed interest in having the military play a larger role in security operations in cities where security has been a major problem that the local police has been unable to fix.
Are guns widely available for criminals to use within Brazil?
Yes, there is a large and thriving market of smuggled weapons into Brazil. And when you go into areas, for example, of my hometown now, Rio de Janeiro, that are controlled by drug gangs, you see gang members carrying rifles with, you know, in plain sight, with complete impunity in areas where the police seldom venture into. However, acquiring weapons legally remains a big hassle here. There's a way to do it, but it requires a huge amount of red tape. The incoming president has said that people, especially people in the countryside, should have an easier time arming themselves to protect themselves against criminals. So whether or not that becomes politically feasible remains to be seen, but it is clear from the turnout of the election that many voters favor that.
Also, the rhetoric that President-elect Bolsonaro has engaged in, where it's been widely portrayed as misogynistic, as hostile to gay men and lesbians. Did he tone down any of that rhetoric during the course of the election, or has he addressed those sorts of slurs from earlier in his career?
He has tried to dial back some of those problematic statements. For example, he has now tried to cast himself as somebody who's not against the LGBT community, despite the fact that he has been quoted in televised interviews saying, for instance, that he would rather have a dead son to a gay son. He also says that he supports women and that any remarks from his past have been taken out of context. However, on his rhetoric regarding, for example, the military dictatorship, which he has praised in the past, and on his on the language he uses to describe his political opponents on the left, if anything, he has become more extreme and more radical. Just days before the election, he delivered a pretty remarkable, fiery speech during which he said political opponents would be banished from Brazil and would be given the option of being vanquished or exiled. So this is somebody who is very at odds with politics as usual in Brazil, and who has found that voters respond favorably to that, at least millions of voters who supported him.
We're talking with Brazil bureau chief of the New York Times, Ernesto Londoño, who's in Rio de Janeiro, talking with us about the new president, Jair Bolsonaro, a far-right candidate who won rather handily. I wonder what's in store for economic changes. Ernesto, you have any sense of ways in which the federal government might change its approaches to the business community, or willingness to modify the outgoing president's approach to the economy?
Sure. There has been consensus here among the political elite for some time that some major structural reforms are in order and will be needed sooner rather than later. One of them is pension reform. There is a huge and very bloated pension system here that nobody has been able to tackle and pare down. Mr. Bolsonaro has now recently expressed an interest in trying to tackle that soon while he has some political capital. But it will be, politically very unpopular in the short term to sell retirees on the idea that they should get smaller checks now and well into the future. On some broader economic policy issues, though, it's a big mystery. Mr. Bolsonaro has said he wants to pursue trade with allied countries, but when he was pinned down on specific questions regarding economic policy as a candidate, he said, I am a former captain in the military. I don't really need to be responding to macroeconomic questions. We'll sort them as they come along. markets rallied, and I think a significant number of people in the investor class saw him with guarded optimism. But I think, you know, across the board, it is a mystery how he and his team will actually handle one of the largest economies in the world.
And real briefly, Ernesto, before I let you go, what's been the reaction throughout South America? Have other leaders commented on the election of Bolsonaro?
Yes, he's received congratulations from leaders across the board. There was one very notable guarded message from his neighbor in Venezuela. Mr. Bolsonaro campaigned warning that Brazil could not turn into the type of socialist nation that Venezuela became as it was became mired in crisis. And the Venezuelan president issued a statement that conveyed alarm about the possibility that Brazil will now take a harder line against its neighbor in the north.
All right. Thank you so much, Ernesto. Really appreciate your talking with us from Rio. Appreciate your coverage of the election result in Brazil.
My pleasure.
That's Ernesto Londoño, Brazil bureau chief for the New York Times. Coming up, we turn our attention to Germany. We'll talk about the future of Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, and what's going on in German politics, as there's been a tremendous backlash against the higher numbers of immigrants and refugees that Germany has taken in over the past few years. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in our second hour, we're going to take an entire half hour to debate Proposition 6 on your November 6th California ballot. That's the repeal of the gasoline tax and the increase in the vehicle license fee. It also requires voter approval for any future gas tax or VLF increases. So we'll debate that coming up the second hour on Air Talk right here on 89.3. But right now we turn our attention to German politics. Yesterday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel announced this, her fourth term would be her last, and that she would not seek re-election to chair the center-right Christian Democratic Union. Her term comes to a close in 2021. She would not continue to attempt to serve as chancellor as well. Angela Merkel's chancellorship has become much more challenged recently as many Germans have grown far more concerned about the number of refugees that have been accepted in Germany over the past 3 years or so. With us, the Berlin bureau chief for The Washington Post, Griff Witte. Griff, thank you for joining us.
It's good to be here.
How surprising was it, if at all, that Chancellor Merkel said she was not going to seek to continue in the position past 21?
Her position had been weakening for some time. It's been a very, very rough year for the chancellor. She, starting with elections in September of 2017, when her party underperformed. Since then, she had a very difficult time putting together a coalition government. The government, once it was formed, was marked by really intense feuding and an inability to get things done. And just in the last few weeks, we've seen regional elections where the CDU, her party, has really suffered. They've taken some hits. So she was definitely on the downswing. Her influence was waning. But I think a lot of people were still caught off guard by the timing of this announcement. She was someone who had said repeatedly that she was going to run for re-election as chair of her party at the party's conference in December. Obviously, that's not going to happen now.
And is this, you know, what percentage of this would you say is about discontent over the acceptance of large numbers of refugees?
I think that's part of it, but it's not the whole story. You've seen in the last few years that the CDU has faced a real challenge from its right in the form of the Alternative for Deutschland party, the AfD, which has taken, siphoned off maybe about 10-12% of the vote on the right side from the CDU. But the CDU is also being hurt from the center. You see the Green Party, which until recently had been pretty fringe in Germany, now all of a sudden doing very, very well in these regional elections, also doing very well in national polling. And a lot of the new Green supporters say that they are defectors from the CDU, that they don't like the fact that the CDU or elements of the CDU are pushing to the right, and they are defecting to a more progressive party. So you see the CDU really caught in between. They've styled themselves as a center-right party. Under Merkel, they had become much more of a true centrist party, and now they're being hurt from both the left and the right side.
Is there someone that's an heir apparent to Angela Merkel's position within the party who might be able to attract more support, or is this just seem pretty clear it's going to fracture German politics?
Well, I think that the CDU is hoping that somehow they can reclaim their status as what's called a Volkspartei, which means People's Party, a party that is broadly representing the German public and is not necessarily just a narrow interest group. But what you've seen over the last year is a real fragmentation of the political scene in Germany and what had been a fairly stable system that was dominated by two longstanding parties. All of a sudden, it's a six-way race in Germany among different parties that each have a particular segment of the population that they represent. And it's going to be very challenging for whoever succeeds Merkel to recapture that broad representation of the population. There's going to be pressure on whoever is the successor to take the party either to the right or to keep it where Merkel has kept it, which is to say in the center. And either way, there are going to be people who are alienated by that decision and who will vote for one of the other parties. The fact is that the CDU has been in power for a very long time, 13 years now. And it's very difficult for a party that has governed for so long, even though the CDU rightly boasts of its accomplishments, which are many. This is a country, Germany, that has in many ways never had it so good. It's economically prosperous. Crime is quite low, despite what you may hear from certain people tweeting. And, Germany is, by many, many measures, a country that is succeeding.
Well, and is there much internal debate within the CDU over whether it needs to move to the right on immigration and status of refugees?
There is, certainly. There is, you saw with the sister party of the CDU, the CSU, which is in Bavaria, they moved very strongly to the right and tried to mimic the AfD's language on immigration. That didn't work out well for them. They were punished in elections a couple of weeks ago in Bavaria. But you still have an element within the CDU that would like to take that tack. There's a politician by the name of Jan Spahn who wants to make the CDU into a more true right-wing party. But there are also candidates vying to replace Merkel, including one who's got the nickname Mini Merkel, who want to take it basically in the same direction that Merkel has taken it, which is to say a centrist direction, but to put a new face on the party so that it's a party that's led by someone with new approaches, new blood, doesn't have the same kind of baggage that Merkel does after 13 years in power.
Griff, you know, I think the sense a lot of Americans have is that there's kind of a gravitas about Merkel that allowed her to, have sort of a prime leadership position within the EU generally. And if that's true, is there anyone, that might be your successor who just because of Germany's strong economy would have that position or not?
Certainly, whoever is chancellor of Germany is going to have a very strong position. Germany is such an economic force. It's such a political force in Europe. So, it's the largest economy in Europe by far. So with the title of chancellor of Germany comes a lot of power. That being said, the candidates to succeed her are all pretty low profile. None of them have much of a profile at all outside of Germany. All right. And many of them are not even well known within Germany.
Griff Witte, thank you so much. Appreciate your being with us and describing what's going on in German politics.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks. Griff is Berlin bureau chief for The Washington Post. Coming up, much more as we prepare you for the upcoming November 6th election. It's Air Talk.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by November 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're going to give you a break a little bit later this hour from all the political news. We're going to talk about sex. I know it's been a while since we've taken on the subject. There's a new study out of the University of Utah which claims that married couples who had few or no other sexual partners before marriage are much happier in their marriages than those who had more partners premaritally. We'll talk about that and take your calls coming up. But first, one of the very biggest of the ballot propositions, Prop 6. You have a chance to vote on November 6th or voting by mail in advance. It would repeal the increase in the gasoline tax passed by the California legislature. It would also repeal the increase in the vehicle license fee. And it would require that voters approve any increases in the future for both. Joining us is a gentleman who chairs the Yes on 6 campaign, former San Diego City Council member and current radio host of the DiMaio Report for AM 600 Cogo San Diego, Carl DiMaio. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So share with us the idea behind 6 and why you think it's important for Californians to repeal the increase.
Well, there are two reasons why we urge a yes vote on Prop 6. First and foremost, the cost of living in California has skyrocketed higher and higher, and working families can barely keep up. The gas tax and the car tax is highly regressive. It hurts those at the lower end of the spectrum the most. And let's remember that prior to this increase that gives us the highest gas tax in the country, we had the fourth highest gas tax. So we've already been paying enough money, which leads me to the second point. A yes vote on Prop 6 sends a message to the politicians, stop stealing our existing gas tax funds. They've been diverting those funds away from the roads for every single year. They always promise us road repairs, then the money gets diverted, and it's still happening. It will continue to happen. In fact, our alternative plan that we offered said that after we repeal the gas tax with a yes vote on Prop 6, if you allocate 100% of the lowered gas tax to roads, you would be able to increase road project funding by $2.3 billion above what they're giving us right now with the gas tax increase.
That's annually? Or?
Annually. No, that's annually. And those are not my numbers. Those are the numbers from the nonpartisan legislative analyst office.
So that wouldn't include the bike projects,
It would include bike projects.
Oh, it would.
But
okay.
as it relates to transit, we also provide for an ongoing stable transit investment by diverting our car sales tax, which is, again, an existing tax, to transportation investment as a whole. That will increase transportation funding by $5.5 billion a year, a total of $8 billion in annualized investment in infrastructure, because we've actually fallen behind where we ought to be in infrastructure investment. And it's not because we're not paying enough in taxes. It's because those politicians are diverting the money.
So the state share of the automotive sales tax, does that just go to the general fund now?
Yes, it does. It goes to the general fund. And again, what we're saying is that if you are going to put a tax on a car, in this case a sales tax, if you're going to tax gasoline, we ought to make sure that those monies go to infrastructure investment. Infrastructure investment has been neglected, and it's something that we consistently see polling at the top of the public opinion polls in terms of where they'd like to see improvements made. But what is so shocking about what the politicians have done on the gas and the car tax increase is that instead of earmarking these funds exclusively for transportation, instead of making sure that the existing money also are fully earmarked for roads, we have the diversions that continue. And that's what is outrageous, is that they're adding burdens to working families, people who cannot afford it, and they're still not putting the money into roads.
Hold that thought. Carl DiMaio with us, Yes on 6 campaign chairman. Also with us, the co-chair of the No on 6 campaign, Matt Cate, founder and president of Cate Consulting, former executive director of the State Association of Counties. Matt, thank you for joining us. us appreciate it. First of all, why do you think this is the best way for California to be able to meet its needs for infrastructure?
Well, I think there's no denying the need. We have in California 1,600 bridges that are currently structurally deficient and at risk. We have 50% of our roads are failing or at risk, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers. In fact, they give our road system a D. So we all know that we're spending thousands of hours stuck in traffic, and I think we all agree something has to be done. Keep in mind that Prop 6 would try to solve the problem by removing $5.2 billion in transportation funding out of that already at-risk system, putting our road safety, our bridge safety, and our businesses and our communities at risk. And so it's just an irresponsible measure. And that's why firefighters, police, the Chamber of Commerce, the civil engineers, cities and counties are all opposed to it.
Well, what about Carl's contention that $2.3 billion a year is gleaned from just the old gas tax that could be made available to do highway improvements?
Well, that's not true. The truth is voters just, I think we'll all remember, just this spring passed Prop 69, which mandates, according to the Constitution, that those transportation dollars go to transportation projects. And so I think it's an attempt to just try to get voters to mistrust the current system when they just passed a constitutional amendment to protect those funds.
If California, though, previously had one of the highest gas taxes in the country, why was it so difficult if those funds were kept for road infrastructure repair and improvements? Why is it so difficult for California to have enough money to do it when other states are doing it with a lower gas tax?
Well, you know who scores highest on that ratio of roads and use of the gas tax? It's states like North Dakota and South Dakota, places that just don't have our difficult and complex transportation systems. We have the fifth largest economy in the world. 20% of the goods in America enter and exit through our ports. We trade with every major country in the Pacific Rim. Moreover, the gas tax has been at its current level since 1991. Since then, inflation and fuel economy have eroded the purchasing power of our gas tax dollars by 50%. And so it's no wonder we now have a $138 billion backlog in bridge and road repairs that we have to take on. It's just time.
We're talking with Matt Cade of No on 6, Carl DiMaio, Yes on 6. If you have questions for our guests about what Prop 6 would do and its repeal of the gasoline tax increase and of the VLF, the car license fee increase, we're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Carl, just on the issue of voter approval, is that a simple majority or two-thirds approval required?
It could be simple majority. If it was earmarked, it could be two-thirds. We're already going to do an initiative that would earmark 100% of the gas tax and the sales tax on cars for roads, and that would be a simple majority. So if you would actually increase that tax, that would already be in place in the state constitution.
How
so
is that,
it would be a simple majority.
How is that different than 69, which was
glad
just mentioned?
You asked. Now, Prop 69 was written by the politicians. They call it a lockbox, but this is what? The fourth lockbox that we have voted on? It's like Lucy in the football and Charlie Brown. They dangle road repairs in front of us, and then they take them away. They wrote the language to allow them to divert the money into the general fund if there are shortfalls. There's actually two provisions in Prop 69 that allows that. Plus, if you noticed how so cleverly and slyly Matt used his words, he didn't say the money was earmarked for roads, which is what the voters want. He said it's earmarked for transportation. Well, let's talk all about that definition of transportation. It includes park and rec programs, farm programs, college and university grants, job training programs with union halls. It also includes all of those examples of the bureaucracies that we've identified, where you will have for example, 7 engineers at Caltrans for every 1 project that's active right now, which the LAO's office has identified 3,500 engineers that are excessive at Caltrans. We also have seen in LA Metro here in Los Angeles the purchase of buses that are 5 times the cost of the national average, buses that actually have been documented to have performance problems. And so we're buying buses at $1.65 million per bus at LA Metro, when in fact we should be paying about $300,000. And so those examples all are piling up. And you wonder, why in the world can't we fix the roads with the 4th highest gas tax in the country? The reality is the money's diverted and it's also wasted. And we need accountability before we add to the burdens of working families who many of these folks, they're earning $40,000, $50,000 and they're just simply not able to afford the extra $650 in gas tax.
Matt, Kate, your response to that, that what Prop 69 did was so loosely defined what was an application of those tax dollars to transit that it's really kept significant amounts from making their way to road repairs.
Well, it's not accurate.
Read the initiative, Matt. Read the initiative.
All right, hold on. Matt, go ahead. What's that?
Truth is that voters passed Prop 22 almost 10 years ago, and now Prop 69. The gas tax is truly in a lockbox. The gas tax cannot be used for any other purpose. And the politicians that he broadly discusses and all the stealing, nothing has even been borrowed since Prop 22 passed all those many years ago. Meanwhile, the roads have continued to crumble because there's just not enough funding in the system to manage this enormous and complex transportation structure we have. We can't get a free ride. It's a user fee. If you're on the roads, you have to pay your fair share to keep the roads up. And I think Californians are sick of hitting these enormous potholes, of seeing their car tires pop, their front ends being need to be realigned. In fact, the average taxpayer pays $844 in car repairs every year as a result of these terrible roads. Now, that's a regressive tax.
Can either of you quantify, under the old gas tax, how much money specifically was going into highway road repairs?
Yep.
And then under the increase in the gas tax, how much of a difference? So, Carl?
Senator Morlock, State Senator Morlock is a CPA, and he came out with his study showing that the 2 years prior to the gas tax increase, only 20% of the gas tax went to roads. And that's a generous allocation. You have all these bureaucracies, but they don't actually work on projects.
And this is independent of the state pulling it out for the general fund. We're talking
when they claim it's going to infrastructure,
okay.
20%. But let me also add, if you take a look at the cost of gas in California, it's $1 to $1.25 higher than the national average. The other 49 states don't have a secret stash of crude somewhere. We buy the same commodity market. This is an increase in the cost of living because of state taxes, mandates, and fees. For Matt to suggest that we're getting a free ride, how offensive, Matt. What are you going to do when you tell those working families you're going to pay $650 to $800 more in car tax and gas tax increases on top of about $1,500 that you're paying for
Matt's
a two-car family?
Matt's point is that there'd been no increase in the gas tax since 91.
Glad you brought that up.
And we know cars are far more fuel efficient now.
I know. These are the Jedi mind tricks that Matt likes to throw out. It seems logical, but there's just one problem. We're collecting more gas tax revenue than we've ever collected before. The LAO office issued their assessment of transportation funding in June of this year, showing that every single year the gas tax has continued to increase in revenue to state politicians. Why?
At the level of inflation?
Yes, beyond inflation, because more people are driving and they're driving longer. In fact, California has seen a 40% increase in the number of super commuters. The Pew Foundation did that study. 40% increase since 2014.
Of course,
in super
that could mean that roads are getting much more usage and require more work, right?
Well,
if people are driving more miles.
But my point I'm making is you're collecting more money than ever because while we are more fuel efficient and we celebrate that, we are also seeing more drivers and they're driving longer. Those are fiscal facts. And anything Matt says, you got to kind of truth test it because these are people who've lied to us in the past and they're lying to us now.
Hold on. Carl DiMaio chairs the Yes on 6 campaign. Matt Cate co-chairs No on 6. Again, we're available available 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. So, Matt, Kate, your response to the argument, under the old gas tax, every year we were collecting more and more.
Well, the population has grown to 40 million people in California. And the road system, we now have 50,000 highway miles, 300,000 local streets and roads, 25,000 bridges, all of which need to withstand a 7.5 earthquake. We have fires in the valley, snow in the Sierra. To suggest that this is something, some kind of easy system like they have in the Midwest or in the South is not the case. Moreover, let me correct a couple of points. Number one, Carl, very cagily, says only 20% are used for roads. What he does is he leaves out streets, and he leaves out our highway system from that number. Let's just look at how we're spending the money that we're collecting right now. Of the $5.2 billion that just went into effect about a year ago, we're spending $1.9 billion of that $5.2 on state highways, $1.8 billion on local streets and roads, $560 million on trade corridors, $750 million on local transit, that's not high-speed rail, and $100 million on active transportation. So, yes, there is some money. That $100 million is for people who walk to work and bike to work to make sure they get off of the roads to ease congestion. And then there's 0.04% of the money that goes to other things. People who put gas in their boats or in their ATVs, they get some service from that. But the vast, vast majority is just going straight into our streets and roads and highway system. And if we take that money out of the system, a crumbling system is going to be unsafe. Listen, last year we had 3,600 people die on our roadways, and that is no joke, and there's no denying it.
Well, is that because of
care of this issue?
Lack of repairs of highways, though?
The experts say that bad roads play a significant part in those in a number of those deaths. Now, we don't know exactly how many of the 3,600 were because of it, but a significant role.
I need to break. We'll continue. That's Matt Cate, no on 6. Carl DiMaio, yes on 6. We'll be back with 1 minute, and I'll be asking some of your questions next on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. We debate Proposition 6. On your November 6th California ballot, it would repeal the gasoline tax increase and the increase in the vehicle license fee and require California voters approve any future increases in either one. Susan in Venice says, I want to understand more about the issue of diversion. In what way is the money being diverted to other issues, and who is responsible for diverting it? Where is it going? Let me ask you about that, Matt Cate. So where does the money go aside from streets, highways, definite road investments?
It's nowhere. So the money that's current, that's the $5.2 billion, none of that is going for anything other than road repairs. Now, in the past, it's true that some funds were used to pay back transportation bonds. So we borrowed money for transportation projects, and we paid some of that back with transportation.
With the previous gas tax.
Right, but Prop 22 eliminated the ability to do that, and it's never been done since then.
Nope.
And so, but all we get is one bit of propaganda after another to try to scare people that somehow their money is being wasted when it's not.
Carl DiMaio?
Oh, where do I catch up with the litany of lies? First, you noticed how he said we had a stagnant gas revenue because we didn't increase since the 1990s. But when confronted with the facts, he then changes his argument to population growth. This is a guy who's standing arm in arm with the politicians who have lied to us year after year. They've offered now 4 lockboxes, and they've broken each of the lockboxes. And now he says, trust us this time to behave? No. We've got billions of dollars under the existing gas tax, under the existing sales tax on cars, that can adequately and more than adequately fund our transportation. But we go through and we find the money is being diverted. First and foremost, Prop 69 allows the governor to transfer all the gas tax money out of the transportation fund to cover general fund deficits without of the vote of the legislature, without a vote of the people. That's in the initiative itself. Why? Because politicians know when they have a budget crunch, they want to grab our transportation dollars first.
And does that include the increase funds?
That is the increase funds.
Okay.
Now, look what they did was under the lockbox that they created, they exempted $1.1 billion in truck weight fees. Why do they charge truck weight fees? Because logically, trucks have more damage
wear
to the
tear.
Roads. You know where those monies are going? $1.1 billion into the general fund. And so, again, Matt, how many times are you going to sit here and lie to people in the face when they can't pay their rent at the end of the month? Shame on you for
right,
raising the cost of living and lying to
let's
people.
Let's not get personal.
But
let's
you know what? It
personal.
Is personal for very for families
yeah,
that are hurting.
Let's
it's
stay,
personal
let's
when they are
the
lied
pros and cons
to.
Of the issue.
I got
Carl,
it.
Hang on.
But when you're told that you're going to die in a car accident if you don't raise your taxes,
all right,
and,
but,
the, and then the truth is the money's been diverted, it is a very personal
hold, Carl,
issue.
Carl, hold on. So, Matt, would you please respond to that issue about the fungibility of the extra revenue in the gas tax increase and its ability to go in special circumstances to the general fund?
Sure. Let me just read from it. The legislature, this is from the California Constitution, Article 19, Section 1, the legislature shall not borrow revenue from the highway user's tax account and shall not use those revenues for purposes other than those specifically permitted by this article. So it's now if and the gas tax under Prop 22 was eliminated, was separated from all potential, even in cases of whatever kind of emergency, earthquake, fires, invasion, it doesn't matter. Prop 22 locked up the gas tax. And so I think it's important for people to keep in mind that this is what the Constitution says. Now, is it possible that some other funds in that kind of emergency could be borrowed for a short term and then paid back? They have to be under the Constitution. If they ever were to borrow the parts that aren't the gas tax, they would have to pay that back within 3 years. That's the provisions that Carl's referring
no,
to.
No, it's not. No, it's the section that says, notwithstanding Section 80724 and 80726, which allows the governor to transfer monies from any fund to cover general fund shortfalls by just simply sending a letter to the comptroller. And that means that for those budget shortfalls, during those times, the governor can transfer. And
but
the
that
governor
would be
makes
across,
the
term- hold on, that would be across the board, though, then, Carl.
No,
so
it's
how
not.
Would you make a
it's
carve
not.
Out for the gas
no,
tax?
No, it's not. Those provisions are in Prop 69. It's actually written into the gas tax, and that's what we are pointing out. What Matt did not read is the notwithstanding language. Again, you got to
okay.
get lawyers
right, Matt,
looking at this
okay,
stuff.
Let me get Matt back. So, Matt, your response to that.
I am a lawyer, and I've got the provisions right in front of me.
Prop 69.
Yes.
You're reading from Prop 69 and what
okay,
read the notwithstanding language.
Carl, hang on, please. Matt, go right ahead.
So, again, you have to read both Prop 22, which is the first lockbox, and Prop 69, and you have to read all of that in context. And what it provides, the gas tax is locked up. It's in the Constitution. And any provision of the non-gas tax revenue that would be borrowed in a state of emergency would have to be repaid in 3 years, and you can only use it if it's not interfering with transportation projects, even in an emergency. That's really what it says, and that's why it hasn't been borrowed. Nothing has been borrowed since Prop 22 10 years ago, and that's a fact that Carl can't deny.
Absolutely not true. The Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, which understands the notion of tax limitations and has won the lawsuits on these issues, agrees with us and has come out in support of Prop 6 because the money cannot be lockboxed
right.
under the existing language.
Gentlemen, I want to give you each a chance for a final brief statement, 30 seconds or less. For our listeners, let me begin with you, Matt, Kate. Why do you think it's important for our listeners to vote against Prop 6?
Because taking $5.2 billion a year for 10 years, that's $52 billion, out of our transportation system is dangerous and irresponsible. There's a reason why professional firefighters, the Association of California Highway Patrolmen, the civil engineers, get this, the California Chamber of Commerce, the Sierra Club, cities, counties, Governor Brown, they don't
all right.
LA Times, they all agree that we need to fix our roads, and they all oppose Prop 6. And in LA County, you've got Highway 1 that's going to be fixed, 205 miles of Highway 1.
All right.
Five.
Matt.
The I-5, the 110.
Matt, I thank you. Co-chairman of the No on 6 campaign, Carl DiMaio, chair of Yes on 6. A brief reason
sure.
why voters should support.
I love how Matt dangles projects that we've already paid for, saying, hey, I'll give you these projects if you raise your taxes. I mean, that's the height of outrageous hypocrisy. First, the cost of living is too high. This is a regressive tax. By voting yes on Prop 6, you save the typical family $650. If they're a high commuting family, $800 for two cars. Number two, the fraud is outrageous. Demand that our existing gas taxes be put into the roads first before they raise the cost of living. And third, the amount of waste is stunning. Go to the website, gastaxrepeal.org. We've got a number of examples up there of the diversion as well as the waste, including more than half, 57% of Caltrans employees earn $100,000 a year. That's 11,256 separate Caltrans employees pulling in $100,000 or more. This is outrageous. It
right.
needs to stop.
I want to thank you both very much. Carl DiMaio, Yes on 6. Matt Cate, No on 6. And of course, we also have for you our voter game plan. Every single ballot proposition, all 11 of them, will be re-airing that the morning before the election on Monday, November 5th, 11 o'clock hour. You'll hear it here on 89.3 KPEC. Coming up, premarital sex. Does that have any effect on the happiness and stability of marital relationships? We'll get into that in just a moment on Air Talk. A recent study out of the University of Utah claims that Americans who've only had sex with their spouse are more likely to say they're happy in their marriages than those who've slept with multiple partners. The lowest satisfaction reported by women who've slept with 6 to 10 partners. The study finds correlation between the number of an individual's sex partners and their reported marital happiness. But of course, that doesn't say that's necessarily the cause. With us to explore the research, professor of family consumer studies and adjunct professor of sociology at the University of Utah, Nick Wolfinger. He's the author of the study, Does Sexual History Affect Marital Happiness, published by the Institute for Family Studies. Thank you so much, professor, for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So share with us how you conducted the study. Who was surveyed?
It's based on data from the General Social Survey, an annual survey of Americans conducted every year, a couple of years since 1972. So I use data, you know, stretching from the late 80s to the present. So it's a representative sample of Americans.
And does it appear that the correlation is pretty much more premarital partners equals overall less happiness in marriage? Is that what you found?
That is indeed what I found. And I'm glad you're saying correlation, because there's no evidence from this study that this is a causal relationship. In other words, it may simply be that the kinds of people who are likely to have a lot of partners are also the kinds of people who are not well disposed to be happy in their marriages.
Well, yeah. One of the things I thought is that my assumption is people who have more sexual partners are generally probably more novelty-seeking individuals, and that if someone is a high-degree novelty-seeking individual, the likelihood of them being dissatisfied in their marriage is probably greater, because the longer you're in a marriage, the less novel, by definition, it is. It is the norm. I mean, could that be essentially what we're seeing?
Absolutely. There's only one direct bit of evidence for a causal effect, and that's this. People who have a lot of partners before marriage may also have children out of wedlock. And people who get married with kids from previous partners have less happy marriages. So that's one concrete piece of evidence for a direct effect. But other than that, you're absolutely right. It may all just be what academics call a selection effect. The same kinds of people who are novelty-seeking just aren't predisposed to have happy marriages.
We're talking with University of Utah Professor Nick Wolfinger. I'd love to hear from you, your thoughts about this. And do you think that there is potentially anything causal about this, not just correlated? Is it possible that having more premarital sexual partners has a deleterious effect on happiness in marriage? We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. We'll be back right after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up right after us, Fresh Air with Terry Gross. Terry's guest, Jonah Hill, the co-star of Superbad, Moneyball, The Wolf of Wall Street. His new film about a group of skateboarders, mid-90s. Terry Gross talks with Jonah Hill. Coming up just a few minutes on Fresh Air here on 89.3. Right now, we're talking about a study by University of Utah professor Nick Wolfinger, which looks at the correlation between marital happiness and the comparative absence of premarital sex partners, and finds there is a correlation that the more sex partners a person has before they are in their current marriage, the greater the odds are that they are less happy in their marriage. Now, do you think there's anything potentially causal in that, not just correlative? Is it possible that having a greater number of sexual partners before marriage somehow has a negative effect on the quality of a person's marriage? We're at 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. I was wondering how religiousness factors into this, Professor. You know, I went to a Christian college where people tended to marry much younger. They'd be more apt not to have had sexual partners, or at least fewer sexual partners before marriage. They're more apt to have longer-term marriages. Of course, religious people still get divorced, but my understanding is that the numbers are diminished. So I wonder if part of what you're seeing here is the effect of religion on marriages and sexual behavior.
That's a totally reasonable suspicion, and indeed that's what I thought, that it was religious people not having a lot of sex partners and also being happily married. But the data don't seem to bear that out. I adjusted the results for denomination and church attendance, and it made no difference. So you're right that people who are religious and practice their faith by attending services recently, those people do tend to have happier marriages and to stay married, but that can't explain the relationship between sex partners and marital happiness.
All right. I'll just keep tossing theories out.
Sure. It's a good guess. That's what I thought, but it didn't pan out.
Let's talk with Kathleen in Palos Verdes. Good to have you with us on Air Talk.
Hi. Thank you, Larry. I've been married for 18 years, and I really think that the fact that my husband and I did not have multiple partners beforehand has led to happiness in our marriage because there's a higher level of trust. I mean, someone has a pattern of behavior before marriage. They're going to possibly continue that after marriage, and I just felt safer. I knew there was a lower risk of STDs and other venereal diseases and things like that, and has made me say, this is the only one for me. I don't need to go search elsewhere because that level of trust was heightened.
And Kathleen, is that trust based in religion? Is it based in the fact you don't feel like your husband is so seeking novelty that he would be interested in going outside your marriage for sex? What are the ways in which you feel reinforced in the fidelity of the relationship?
I don't have to think, oh, he's been with this partner and this partner, and I can just think it's just the two of us. And it's even just a romantic basis that, you know, I have only had sex with my husband and I'm satisfied, and it's a time together to explore and reinforce that, and it's only the us.
Yeah. And so what you're kind of describing is it makes it even more special. That fact that you've only been with someone else, your husband is the only person you've been intimate with. Kathleen, I appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let me throw this out. Louise in El Segundo called with this, and I think it's an interesting point. She's saying, you know, because people marry later in life, women marry later in life, they're much more apt to have a larger number of sexual partners. lives just because of the age delay. There's more time to have other partners. We also know that the divorce rate appears to be down as people are marrying later, either because they're cohabiting earlier, that's where they break up, they're, you know, for whatever reason, it seems like when people get married and they're older, the likelihood of the marriage staying intact is greater. It would also seem those people would likely have more sexual partners. So, Professor Wolfinger, how do you square that?
So you described several different trends that are affecting today's marriage. So it's true that people are marrying later. That is definitely a reason why the divorce rate is indeed down since it reached its high watermark in 1980 or 1981. That can't be denied. But the later marriage isn't the only reason why people aren't divorcing as much. So you account for early marriage, the less early marriage, and you still see a lower divorce rate. Now, something else interesting has happened in recent years. People who marry when they're 20 have always had very high divorce rates. But in the last few years, we see that people who marry very late have higher divorce rates than people who marry more at the median. So if the median's around 28 to 32, those are the folks that have the lowest divorce rates. Thereafter, divorce rate goes up a little bit. But be that as it may, marriage age can't really seem to explain the relationship between having a lot of sex partners and marital quality. I said a mouthful.
That's right.
Take what you want.
I'll keep throwing pitches.
Please do.
All right. Lucy and Downey, you're on Air Talk. What's your thought about this? Is it possibly causal that having fewer sex partners or no other sex partners before marriage makes the marriage more fulfilling?
I think so. That's not my case, but I do agree with the last caller.
That's funny.
The less partners you have, the better. Why? Because that's all you know. So if you've never had lobster, Larry, you're not going to be walking around going, oh, I wish I had lobster. You don't have any idea what that tastes like. Am I right?
Well, but you don't think, I don't know, because I would still think that if someone is inclined to seeking novelty, they're still going to be, you know, potentially eyeing other people if they're not fully committed. I guess I'm not sure that the commitment is dependent on ignorance, if you know what I mean.
I totally get it. I'll give you my case.
Okay, good.
I'm older than 50, and I was married before, and I had a couple of partners. And right now, I am completely committed for the last 20 years to this guy. Is he the best person in the four walls? No, he's not. But I'm completely committed, and I don't look the other way, or I don't even, you know, I just, he's who I want.
Yeah.
I mean that we were just magic in there. No. That's not the deal.
Lucy, I love it. Thank you for joining us and sharing your personal experience here. 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Pippi on the page, similarly saying, hard to know what's a great sex life if you don't have anything or anyone to compare it with. 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page. Pippi also wonders about polygamists. If they were happy, why would they have more than one spouse? But if course, you know, polygamous, it's not just about marital fulfillment or pleasure. That's typically out of a particular religious interpretation. And I assume, Professor Wolfing, you didn't, that's such a small subset, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's a vanishingly small number of polygamists. There's also a small number of what we call polygamists in California, people practicing polyamory. There are just not enough of them for any kind of rigorous data analysis. And I have to add, I'm now thinking nonstop about a craving for lobster.
All right. I know. All right. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. And so far, only women are on the phone, which obviously we love to hear from women listeners of Air Talk. But gentlemen, I'd also be interested in hearing your thoughts about this. Get a little more. Oh, good. We have a guy who called in. A little more gender balance. Be great. Hear one or two from one or two men. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. We'll continue with University of Utah Professor Nick Wolfinger in 1 minute. Such pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. We're discussing a study that was conducted by University of Utah Professor of Family Consumer Studies Nick Wolfinger. The study is titled, Does Sexual History Affect Marital Happiness? And what his study shows is a correlation, not a cause, but a correlation that the fewer sexual partners someone has before marriage seems to have a positive effect in terms of the happiness someone reports in their current marriage. And those that report the greatest degree of happiness are those who did not have any premarital sexual relationships. People who had one premarital relationship would report the next highest level of happiness, and so on. So my question for you is, do you think there's anything causal in there, that the number of premarital partners does have an effect on the happiness in the marriage, as opposed to there being other factors, novelty seeking or other things, that would just be, you know, sort of symptomatic in what you would see in behavior? 866-893-KPCC. Jeff in Pasadena, good to have you with us. What do you think?
Yes, I kind of wonder what sort of generational factors might play into this as far as how we model our relationships after the ones that we've observed closest in our parents, and seeing, I mean, it's more of a question than any sort of observation.
Yeah.
Of how that might play out as to how younger generations perceive marriage in general or having multiple sexual partners.
So are you talking about the effect of parental modeling? Is that what you mean?
Sure.
Okay.
And kind of the time and place that our parents grew up in. I'm 34, so, you know, the time and place that they grew up in and how societally acceptable and what the expected norms were for them, and how that factors into how we make our own decisions.
Professor Wolfinger?
Yes. One thing that we've seen over the generations is a far lower rate of adultery and extramarital sex. The baby boomers, you know, are the generations who cheat the most, and we're doing it less. There's a big generation gap there. The other broad trend that we always have to think about in marriage is that marriage has become almost a status good for the wealthy. Now the people who are married are much more likely to have college degrees. People who don't have college degrees, less likely to be married. So it's certainly marriage has changed a lot.
So by definition, then, yeah. These are people with more economically stable lives. They're perhaps more rooted because they're able to have more stable lives generally than their marriages.
Yes.
Would reflect that.
Absolutely. 40 years ago, there was no gap in marriage by education. Now there's a huge gap. So the whole life course has changed. It used to be you got married when you were young and everyone did it. Now people wait till they've graduated from college and established in their careers before they get married. So it's more of a capstone. Everyone still aspires to marriage, and most people still marry over the course of their lives, but it's just treated differently than it used to be.
Carol in Mar Vista, thank you for joining us. What are your observations?
Boy, I just kind of disagree with everything this guy just said. I mean, I'm actually a baby boomer. I had many, many sexual partners. If we're going with the fish analogy, I tried lots of different fish. I met a lobster. I married the lobster. you know, I never had aspirations of being married. I never, this thing of everybody wants to get married, I just really disagree with that.
I just have
a pretty high percentage of people do get married. I think that's where that comes from.
I do, but it was not for me, at least, this big aspiration where, you know, I had to get married someday. It just sort of happened. So, no, I've been married now 26 years, and, you know, I had lots of partners before that. So maybe I'm the exception.
Yeah. Well, and again, these are averages. So there are going to be a lot of people who have a lot of sex before they get married and great marital relationships afterwards. And I'm sure there are the opposite, people who come into a marriage with no sexual experience and are miserable in the marriage. But these are averages. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Read in Thousand Oaks, your observation.
Yeah, this is relating back to something that the professor said a bit ago about age. I think that sort of the ideal is to find a happy medium, you know, not too many partners, but also not too few. Because just in my experience, most of my friends that have, you know, very happy marriages, they didn't necessarily, you know, start off with the first person. However, they also didn't, you know, sleep around a lot before they got married.
Yeah, so there was selectivity anyway. So, Reed, you're talking about the Goldilocks approach of, you know, having just the right number of sexual partners. And but, you know, my thought would be, too, is under what conditions were those sexual relationships? Were they positive? You know, were not all sexual experiences are necessarily positive. And if they were parts of relationships, what were those earlier relationships? There's a lot of complexity that's associated with this, too. But Professor Wolfinger, your thoughts about Reed, that sort of, you know, maybe there's a happy medium.
Certainly there's a happy medium when it comes to how many sex partners you have and whether or not you get divorced. There again, people who marry as virgins or one partners have the lowest divorce rates. The people who have the highest divorce rates are strangely people who have two partners. And so if you have more than that, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, it doesn't seem to matter. But you have two, you have that comparison. You have the one that got away. You have the comparison that's overemphasized. And I just wanted to make a point about the difference between us as people with college degrees in educated big cities versus the rest of America. Most Americans don't have a lot of sex partners. The median woman has had four in her life. The median man, you know, five or six. But, you know, here in the city, 10, 20, 30, you know, those numbers aren't so weird.
All right.
But it's not how the rest of the country, you know, conducts themselves.
That's interesting. I didn't realize there was such a difference regionally on the number of sexual partners. Let me share some more listener comments. Yeah. Angelique in Santa Monica says, if someone's been with more people, they might be less apt to be committed. So in other words, that kind of be a symptom of that they're jumping around in sexual partners, and that would be part of the reason that the marriage isn't as happy. Jay in downtown Los Angeles says, it's a matter of knowledge. When we were in school, the more we're exposed to subjects, the more we know about it. So marrying someone without having experience, you're not going to get a better understanding of the relationship. Nilu in West Hill says, I have a 19-year-old son. We're non-religious, but our son became a Christian. He believes he should be celibate before marriage. Nilu says, I worry about him because it's going to cause him to marry sooner, and I'm afraid he'll be bored after getting married. Chuck in the Miracle Mile says, I've been married 14 years in a non-monogamous relationship. Now I'm married for 10 years in a monogamous one. Neither had an impact on my relationship, on the quality of it, and was not related to the number of sexual partners. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. And my thanks to University of Utah Professor Nick Wolfinger for joining us to talk about his study. Have a great afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next.